This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, it's Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Wisconsin has a long history of lighthouses. The duties of their keepers have changed dramatically over the decades, but the people who keep the lights on and the memories of the importance of the lights have not. Patty Murray visited a modern light keeper in Door County.
Cana Island is near Bailey's Harbor on Door County's eastern Lake Michigan side. It's wading distance from shore. It's been there since 1869. The light was electrified in 1934, according to Dwight Zeller, who is Cana's site manager.
Do you call yourself a lighthouse keeper?
No. Maybe it gets labeled that way. The job and role of keeper is the trade of maintaining a good light. In today's world, the function of keeping the light is done by the Coast Guard. Now, with respect to the Coast Guard, I do have some involvement with the light in terms of its periodic maintenance.
Just making sure that you keep the lights on?
Surprisingly enough, keeping the light on is a very easy task once you have electricity.
That means Zeller's work is much easier than that of his predecessors. There were only seven keepers between 1869 and World War II when the Cana Light was transferred to what is now the Coast Guard.
I live in the 21st century and I work in the 19th.
Zeller says that 19th century work was grueling.
Could we go look at it?
That's up to you. I got 97 steps in front of you.
97 steps on the original cast iron spiral staircase. Zeller says that was a trip old-fashioned keepers made every 2 hours at night, carrying buckets of hot lard to fuel the light.
Each stair that we climbed,
right here.
Each handhold on that railing.
Oh my goodness!
Each spot in the floor where some people duck and some are just quite a little bit late.
That's
the same route. Each of those keepers climbed when they were on duty here.
Early keepers were paid $600 a year. Sometimes their wives worked as assistants for a whopping $400. Still, it was important work that still helps keep shippers and recreational boaters safe, even by means of modern technology. The Cana Light is maintained by the Coast Guard. The property is now a Door County park, and the house itself is maintained by the Door County Maritime Museum. Even if the navigational dangers aren't as perilous as they once were, Zeller says lighthouses are part of Wisconsin's and America's history.
Taking a moment to share something that is becoming more and more exclusive, simply because the lighthouses are disappearing, with the public who perhaps has a chance to learn just a little bit about him.
Already?
I want to marry a lighthouse keeper and keep him company. I want to marry a lighthouse keeper and live by the side of the sea.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
For years, scientists have reasoned music is popular, it's ancient, and continually ranked as one of the most supreme pleasures of life. Given all that, they wondered, is there a region of the brain that responds specifically to music? It's not that far-fetched. For instance, there is a region of the brain that deals specifically with visual cues like faces. For a long time, scientists couldn't find a similar area of the brain that responded to music until recently. A research team at MIT has been given a peek into what's being called the brain's music room. Using functional MRIs, they've identified the specific neural pathways that react almost exclusively to music. Here to talk about the findings are two members of that team from MIT. Nancy Kanwisher is a professor at MIT and an investigator at the McGovern Institute for Brain Research. Her lab uses MFRI to investigate the functional architecture of the human brain. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And also with us today, we've got Sam Norman Hagner, postdoctoral researcher at MIT, whose work focuses on understanding the human auditory cortex. Sam, welcome.
Thanks.
And so, Nancy, going into this research, what exactly were you looking for?
Well, as background, I've been looking for the last 20 years or so at the overall organization of the human brain. So we think that's a really exciting question because it's basically a way to ask, who are we? What are our brains made up of? What are the basic components of the human mind? And that's been a very exciting research program, and we've discovered a lot of specialized regions of the brain that respond very selectively to when you do very specific kinds of things, like face recognition, or reading a word, or thinking about what another person is thinking, or understanding a sentence. Each of those activates a very specific part of the brain. And so we wanted to know for a long time whether music might be another mental function that has its own special purpose brain machinery. So that was a tough question to answer until Sam came along. So maybe he can tell you what he's done.
Right. And Sam, why did music seem like such a likely candidate for dedicated brain architecture, so to speak?
Well, one of the nice things about the approach that we use to reveal this putatively music selective region is that the analysis that we used to find it basically didn't know anything about what it should find. Didn't know whether it should find something that was selected for music or speech or, you know, whatever else. And so as a result, when we ran this analysis and it basically revealed this neural population that responded selectively to music, we found that sort of particularly striking because basically the analysis didn't know anything about what it should find a priori.
So you said this is a kind of a neutral way. This is computational. How did this work? How did you get to this answer, Nancy?
The simple way of thinking of it is we start with a large amount of data. So we have 10,000 individual three-dimensional pixels or voxels across 10 subjects' brains in their broader auditory cortex, and we know the magnitude of the response of each of those pixels to each of 165 different sounds. So that's 18 million numbers. And then what we do is we ask the math to simplify this and give us a simple description of the data, and it basically finds six simple components that can account for most of the data. And that didn't have to be. That was a cool result in itself, that we could understand and characterize the response of the brain to this wide array of different kinds of sounds with six simple patterns. And it just emerged when we looked at those six patterns that one of them reflected selectivity for music. And that's just remarkable because the space of possible things we could find is just enormous. And the fact that one of them very neatly mapped on, just when we looked at it, you could just see, oh, that's music selectivity, a high response to all of these wildly different kinds of music sounds, and a low response to everything else. So it just popped right out of the raw data.
And I want to give a listen to some of the things that your subjects were listening to, because you have a whole array of, I guess, auditory cues, different sounds, and music. Let's listen to the sounds first.
It's supposed to either rain or snow.
Hannah is good at compromising.
Okay, so you've got the stuff of everyday life there. You've got toilets flushing. You've got people talking. You've got people brushing your teeth. The brains of your subjects heard all that. And they also heard some music. They heard stuff like this. So they heard all that, tons of different styles of music there, all those different sounds mixed in. How did the brain tell them apart?
Well, so, I mean, like, one of the interesting aspects of the finding is that this music selective population that we discovered responded to lots of different types of music. And one of the sort of interesting facts about music in general is that music is a remarkably heterogeneous category. There are lots of different types of things that people typically call music. And it's very different from the types of categories that we know exist for other types of things. So, for example, speech is a much more homogenous category. You know, the different types of speech sounds that people encounter are in some sense much more similar than the different types of music that we encounter. And so the fact that you find a brain region that responds in some sense strongly to all of these different types of music is sort of one of the interesting results of the experiment.
And I just wanted to back up a moment. music is fascinating because every human culture that's been studied has it, and no animal that's been studied has anything approaching human music. And so it's both uniquely and universally human, and yet at the same time, nobody even knows why we have it. So evolutionary theorists have been fighting for a long time trying to understand why we have music, and nobody has a really clear story about why we have it. And so one story was that music just kind of piggybacks on other brain mechanisms, for example, mechanisms for understanding speech or processing language or God knows what else, right? And what our result shows is understanding music or perceiving music isn't just a byproduct of other mechanisms. It has its own special purpose mechanism. So it's its own thing. It's not a byproduct. And I think that's a fascinating result of this research.
We're talking right now with Nancy Kanwisher and Sam Norman Hagner, part of the team that use functional MRIs to locate specific neural pathways in the brain that respond exclusively to music. And as you were saying, Nancy, from an evolutionary perspective, it doesn't seem like music would be as important to survival as, say, speech. So what do we know about why music may have this privileged role in the brain, and how is that going to change the way that we think about music?
Well, the why questions are very hard. I think the answer could easily have been otherwise, and it's an empirical result that, wow, apparently we do have this special purpose machinery. The question of why different mental functions get specialized machinery in the brain is a really big, important one, but we just don't know the answer. And I want to mention that, like, not everything that has special machinery in the brain is the product of evolution and natural selection. So, for example, there's a part of the brain that responds very selectively and strongly to visually presented words. And that can't be a result of natural selection because people haven't been reading long enough for evolution to have crafted it. So we shouldn't assume that just because there are special neural mechanisms for music that they've evolved. It may be that they result from extensive experience with music. And this is something we can't tell yet from our current experiments. But Sam has lots of ideas of what to do next to find out.
Right, and I'd love to hear that, Sam. Where would you like to see this research go from here?
So there are a lot of sort of open questions about what this specific music population does. So, for example, you asked the question of, you know, how does your brain differentiate between all the different types of music that you typically listen to? And that's basically a question that we don't really know the answer to. We know that there's, you know, this population that responds strongly to lots of different types of music, but we don't know, for example, whether there are subpopulations within this area that, say, respond to musical rhythms or to musical pitches or to musical harmonies. Basically, we don't know how all of the different aspects of musical structure that you're sensitive to and care about are mapped in this population and other populations of the brain.
Does this tell you as a researcher, though, just for the layperson, that, yeah, there's a reason why we respond so powerfully to music?
That's a very hard question, I think, to answer. I mean, it suggests that music is a sufficiently sort of important category to warrant, you know, a relatively large piece of tissue to process it. But exactly how that maps onto, you know, our appreciation of music and the emotional impact that music has on us is a sort of a harder question to answer, I think.
All right, we'll leave it there. Nancy and Sam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
That was Nancy Kanwisher and Sam Norman Hagner. They're part of a team that used functional MRIs to locate specific neural pathways in the brain that respond to music. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Foxconn has chosen the site of its future Wisconsin factory. In a report released by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the new site will be Mount Pleasant. The Taiwanese tech company was set to announce that location tomorrow. Laurel White joins us now. She's a state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Laurel, this information obtained a little bit before it was looks like supposed to be to the public, saying that Mount Pleasant is the site that's been chosen. Tell us more about where this information came from.
So this has been a really fast-moving story over the past couple hours. So we just got the announcement about the site selection press availability. So we got the release saying, hey, we're going to announce the Foxconn site in Sturtevant tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. So we were all kind of getting ready for that, for it to be made official tomorrow morning. And then the Journal Sentinel broke this story that the location is going to be in the southwestern corner of Mount Pleasant, Now, they're basing their reporting. This hasn't been confirmed by Foxconn officials or anybody in the Walker administration or anything like that. They're basing their reporting on some interviews that they started doing way back in the summer with property owners in the area who were being offered money to buy their land, presumably for the Foxconn facility.
And it sounds like Representative Pitts Brothers and Associates, it's a Kenosha real estate firm, have been approaching landowners looking for property and buying up property. So this has been going on for a bit. Do we know how much property has been needed?
So a lot. I was concerned you were going to ask that question because I don't remember the exact acreage that the Foxconn facility is going to need. I know that it's 11 Lambeau fields. So that's a statistic that the governor's been throwing out a lot. So that's quite a few acres. And we do know also from the Journal Sentinel reporting that that real estate firm was offering landowners, according to their reporting and their conversations with the landowners, $50,000 an acre, which is substantially more than the average price per acre in that area. The Journal Sentinel says it was about $8,000 an acre. So a hefty price for these Mount Pleasant farmers for their land that will be taken over, we think, according to this reporting by Foxconn.
And Laurel, take us back a little bit, if you would. Initially, Kenosha was the name that kept getting floated. Kenosha dropped its bid, and now we're at Mount Pleasant, reportedly. Tell us what happened and why Kenosha dropped out.
Well, we always knew that it was going to be Racine County or Kenosha County, kind of that southwestern part, the southern part of Wisconsin, for the Foxconn facility. But as negotiations evolved and kind of things became a little bit more clear about what was going to be required of municipalities if Foxconn located in their area, the city of Kenosha, the Kenosha area, actually dropped out of the Foxconn bidding process. The land that had been investigated there, I believe, was around the town of Paris in Kenosha County. And it was kind of a similar situation where a real estate firm was going and offering money to landowners. But then last month, Kenosha said, hey, this is just going to be too expensive, we think, for our local governments to foot the bill for some of the infrastructure developments related to Foxconn. And we're just not feeling comfortable getting into that situation. So they bowed out, and that left Racine County and this Mount Pleasant opportunity, really the only one in the running for Foxconn. So that seems to be what's gotten wrapped up here.
And it looks like we should get the official news tomorrow, some unofficial news, which will verify, of course, tomorrow, about Foxconn being located, the plant in Mount Pleasant. Laurel, thanks so much for getting us up to speed on that.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Right now, another installment in our series State of Change, a collaborative effort between Central Wisconsin farmers and lakefront homeowners, is working to solve one of the region's persistent environmental problems. As Glenn Moberg reports, they're working to eliminate blue-green algae in the Wisconsin River watershed.
In August of 2016, Rick Georgeson was livid about the blue-green algae in front of his home on Lake Peatonwell, a flowage on the Wisconsin River.
Light green, dark green, it's sticking to the rocks, it's floating in mats out on the lake. It smells like raw sewage. It stinks.
Blue-green algae is a kind of bacteria that grows on surface water because of hot weather and phosphorus pollution. It can cause serious sickness if ingested. That summer, it killed a dog that swam in a nearby lake. One year later, it's a different scene. Families are fishing in the harbor, and Rick Georgeson is sitting in a pontoon boat, smiling.
The water has been about the best it's been in many, many years. It's been a cool summer.
But while the algae isn't as bad this year, it's still a chronic problem for Peatonwell and the Castle Rock flowage to the south. Georgeson guides the pontoon into the open water. 2 miles down the coast, there it is, a bright green ooze on the surface. He says in hot summers, the algae can drive tourists away.
We've seen people come to the beach and open the car door, the kids get out and run down to see the water, and they get back in and leave. It's just sad.
Georgeson is the president of an environmental homeowners group called the Peatonwell and Castle Rock Stewards, or Packers. They've reached out to local farmers to try to stop the phosphorus fertilizer runoff that is feeding the algae. Georgeson organized a meeting at the Technical College, and that's where he met the head of the Portage County Farm Bureau, John Aaron.
And he shakes my hand, he says, "Tell you what, if you bring the lake people up to my farm, I'll bring the farmers to the lake."
We could use some rain, just not all at one time.
32 miles to the north on his 800-acre farm, John Aaron talks with UW Extension Ag agent Ken Schrader about that first meeting with Georgeson.
Rick kind of leaned over and said hi, and I was like, you know, maybe you guys aren't as scary as people thought you were. We really have common goals.
The big common goal is stopping phosphorus fertilizer runoff.
We want to keep nutrients and soil on the land. Obviously, as a farmer, we don't want to see runoff and see the fertilizer that we've spent money to apply leave our property.
Aaron and Schrader think the answer lies in no-till agriculture and cover crops. It means not digging up the soil in the spring and sowing the seeds directly into a root mass formed by a cover crop that's planted in the fall. Schrader says it's soil protection.
The point with cover crops is we want to cover that soil and prevent the water from splashing on that soil and moving it downstream.
We're not digging up the soil in fall, and we're not digging it up in spring.
We climb into John Aaron's truck, and he drives into a field of healthy soybeans planted during an unusually wet spring using no-till and a cover crop. A plowed field nearby was too muddy to plant.
With the crazy weather we've had, I really wasn't delayed much with planting. With the amount of root mass we had, it was able to hold the equipment. We were able to plant into it.
Ag agent Schrader says the techniques will be even more important as the climate continues to warm.
With the climate change and the heavier rains coming that are 1 inch plus, it's a challenge keeping soil in place.
Aaron and Schrader say what's good for local farms is good for Lake Peatonwell.
Definitely a win-win. Everything we can do to retain soil and nutrients on our properties, a win for us, and it's a win for the Peatonwell and Castle Rock Stewards.
The way we're going to get things done is everybody working together, coming to the table, talking about it, and supporting each other.
Lakefront homeowner Rick Georgeson agrees.
I'm very hopeful for the future. They win by keeping the soil in their land, and as a result, the water's cleaner.
Instead of being adversaries, farmers and environmentalists here have discovered that they can solve a common problem by being friends and partners. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
This story is part of a year-long reporting project at WPR called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. Find stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Ideas Network, and online at WPR/change. Coming up, we'll look at health in our series First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tomorrow after 8 on The Morning Show, host Kate Archer-Kent and our guests look at how we can recover from horrors like the Holocaust, while also making sure that we don't lose the lessons they can teach us. Right now, we're continuing our series, First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today, with a look at health in Native communities. Jody Harris is a maternal child health nurse for the Forest County Potawatomi Community Health Department. Jody, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Jody, could you tell us what you do at the Community Health Department?
Sure. So we wear many hats here, but mostly the Community Health Department is kind of a link to provide care to FCP tribal members and their families through skilled nursing, case management, referrals to community resources. We offer disease and injury prevention through education and immunizations. Community health offers health promotion and chronic disease prevention through events and programs and educational materials.
And what are the priorities of the Community Health Department?
So we provide essential public health services and respond to the health care needs of the FCP community. In 2012, we did a CHA, which is a community health assessment, and that led to a CHIP, which is our community health improvement plan. And that identified three areas of focus, including injury prevention, obesity, and AODA mental health issues.
And I know prevention is a big part of your goal. You mentioned a few of those, but flesh out the prevention angle. What are you looking to improve upon there?
We're always looking to encourage people to get out and exercise and eat right. We did something this last weekend where we were able to host a Swine Dine and Dash, we called it, and it's an event that we collaborated with our Land and Natural Resources Department, where we offered a day fun event where we encouraged people to get out and walk with their families. They walked around the farm. They could choose a 2-mile or a 3-mile route. That introduced the farm that the tribe is newly established and where they were able to grow a lot of fruits and vegetables, some cattle, chickens. So the families were able to participate in that while having a great time. So and getting out there and exercising as well.
Oh, sounds like a fun event. Mm-hmm. And Jody, you're a maternal child health nurse. Can you tell us about your role in that aspect?
Sure. So the MCH program, we have new moms, expecting moms, parents. They come into our office. We reach out to them. We're able to provide with education and resources, anything maternal child health related, childbirth, breastfeeding, immunizations, car seat safety, safe sleep, healthy growth and development. Families come in. We establish a great relationship with their families, and they're able to receive education, support, and like I mentioned earlier, immunizations. We wear many hats in community health. Today is our infant nutrition program, where we're able to offer education related to nutrition for infants, and then also information about healthy growth and development. We do a weight and a height, and they're able to talk to parents or able to talk to a dietitian about what baby should be eating and appropriate habits like that. So we have a day like today where lots of our babies are coming in. Tomorrow I'll be traveling to Oneida Nation and supporting them in a partner meeting. Last week I participated in a community or a coordinated service team, which is really like a wraparound group for a mom who really needs a lot of support, and we collaborate with other departments. So the days are very different every single day. No day is the same, but there's a wide variety of programs we're able to offer to our families.
We're talking with Jody Harris right now. She's a maternal child health nurse for the Forest County Potawatomi Community Health Department. And Jody, I know that where the clinic is located, it's not necessarily a quick stop for everybody who comes to you and seeks your services, but how important a role is the community health department in the community in giving access to people for the kind of healthcare and the kind of services that you provide?
Sure. We really are a one-stop shop. We have lots of services here at the Health and Wellness Center, our medical department, a pharmacy, optical, dental, behavioral health, AODA. So we have a lot of services available, and I think the community relies on us for those, not just Forest County Potawatomi community members, but the entire Forest County and beyond.
And we were talking a little bit about the maternal health programs, and one of these is called the NEST program. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah. So our MCH participants, they can accrue NEST points through participation in the program, and then they use those points to be redeemed in the NEST, we call it. Moms earn points through attending events. We have monthly education events. Breastfeeding, they're able to get points for well child visits, immunizations. We get points for first dental visits, office visits, home visits, 6-week postpartum visits. We do infant and prenatal assessments. So they're able to get points for all of those. And it's really like a mini Walmart in there. So anything from diapers and wipes and toys, books, clothes, blankets.
And so they can redeem the points for all of those things.
Mm-hmm, right. It's a great, successful program. We have I think sometimes it's the reason why we have people come and visit us in community health. A lot of tribal members use the program, really well received by our families.
Respecting confidentiality, I wonder if you could tell us about the kinds of needs and the kind of success stories that have come out of this clinic.
Sure. Community health has a lot of success stories. We have a diabetes program that really works together with our maternal child health program. We really work together for the health of the community. And so when we see a family who's participating in a fall hike or at like our 5Ks or coming to events together, I think that alone speaks a lot to what we do here and that we're promoting family and health in the same time. We talk about everything from reading from a very early age. We encourage breastfeeding. So sometimes we'll have moms who don't know a thing about breastfeeding, and we definitely want them to at least explore the option, and just talking about it and establishing a great relationship with our moms helps establish a very healthy future for that baby. And so I guess we get success stories, and that's kind of what we thrive on, is those great things that are coming out of our department.
You're painting a picture of a community clinic health department with a key role in the community around it. Are there other areas of Wisconsin maybe serving other tribes that are at this point not getting the care and the health attention that they need that could use this maybe as a model?
Yeah, well, community health, or Forest County Potawatomi Community Health, is very fortunate that we have the funding and the supports from our tribe to support something like the NEST and this great robust community health that we have. And I think that there are other tribes that are not as fortunate and unable to support a program like what we have. Fortunately, a lot of programs can be supplemented through grants through the state or federal government. And we do have people who look to us. We are definitely a leader in the things that we do and the programs that we're able to initiate.
Jody, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Jody Harris, maternal child health nurse for the Forest County Potawatomi Community Health Department. First Wisconsinites continues now. Coming up, we'll learn about the Ho-Chunk Weightlifting Club in just a minute here on Central Time.
Ladies and gentlemen,
when you're on social media, visit the new Facebook page dedicated to the Ideas Network on WPR. You'll find links to the Ideas Network programs you listen to every day, information on the issues important to people across the state, and perspectives from our talk show guests. Find more online at facebook.com/theideasnetwork.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our dive into the topic of health in Native American communities as part of our series, First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today. Paul Roberts is with us now. He's co-founder of the Ho-Chunk Weightlifting Club and is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. Paul, welcome to Central Time. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, what is the Ho-Chunk Weightlifting Club?
So the Ho-Chunk Weightlifting Club is a group of Native Ho-Chunk weightlifters that come together to basically uplift each other. We say uplift each other's spirits. It's not really about weights. You know, it's more about physical fitness and exercise and giving yourself the confidence to, you know, go after life and try to better your physical being. And through bettering your physical being, you're going to better your spiritual, mental, emotional.
And this is something that you're not just talking the talk on. You've walked the walk. You have had a journey to get to the point where you are, where you're inspiring other people to look at their health and their wellness and their spiritual health as well. And it didn't come easy. It started with a death.
Yeah. My father figure in my life, myself, grew up like a lot of other Native children out there, without a father figure. And that was pretty hard growing up, not ever having that. And my uncle was my father figure. He was the one that stepped up. He was the one that kind of took on that role when he could. It wasn't all the time that he was there, because he had two other daughters that he took care of very well. He was an amazing father. He passed away, and I didn't know how to deal with that. I really didn't. I completely shut down, and I think I started using alcohol, drugs, as an escape to the reality that I was living. it was pretty tough. Found myself well over 300 pounds. I think when I did actually look at the scale, because I didn't really like being looking at mirrors, looking at pictures or anything like that, I was just shy of 340 pounds at my heaviest.
And that's when your story took a turn. You started to turn toward what was going to be your future. What happened next?
Well, I kind of realized that I needed to do something different, to start to try to do something I was used to doing, and that was lifting weights. I did lift weights when I was in high school, and actually went to a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center. And while I was there, I witnessed, we got to go to a gym. And while we were there, you know, I got to walk around the weight room a little bit, and it was like something almost calling to me. So when I came back home from this rehabilitation center, I actually started wanting to exercise again. So it was at the Ho-Chunk House of Wellness, where I currently work now as a fitness specialist and strength coach. But I actually just started walking on the treadmill, and found that I couldn't even walk. It was really hard for me to even try to run. So it really started just being at the gym and exercising by myself.
You said that when you walked by the gym, you felt something almost calling to you. How did you know what you were hearing and what you wanted and needed to do at that point?
I guess it was something familiar. It was something like realizing something I knew. You know, I was in a place where I didn't know what was going on. In a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center, you get to see some of the most damaged people out there. You know, I mean, it's really sad when you get to see that other side of people that suffer from drug addiction, alcoholism. You know, it's so much deeper than a lot of people think. I think a lot of people have this notion that, oh, why don't you just stop? You know, it's so much deeper on this emotional and spiritual, broken spirit kind of journey. And I guess being there was really scary. And realizing that I was in that spot, going into the weight room, it was something familiar. It just felt like something was calling to me.
For a lot of people who are moving toward a goal or coming out of a dark place, it's not so easy seeing destination B and trying to get there from destination A. Your story had some twists and turns. You had another loss mm-hmm. in your life, another one that shook you. And this was the one that afterwards, though, it really stuck.
Yeah.
Your new path. Tell us about that.
Well, I had another uncle that kind of stepped up. He took the place of my uncle that was there. And actually, he knew that I was on this path of trying to be sober and trying to better myself. And he really kind of, you know, took that upon himself to help me out, to uplift me, he actually gave me a bow to start shooting. And he unfortunately passed away from cancer. And I actually got to take him to some of his chemotherapy treatments. And it's really hard to see somebody that you know that was very active. He was a coach. He was a coach in Arizona. He actually took his basketball team to state. Amazing man. And to see a person, you know, wither away from cancer is very, very tragic. And it's really hard to witness, to see that happen. And when that happened, I guess I kind of fell back into that shutdown mode and started to drink again and utilize alcohol and drugs. And that was kind of where when I had this epiphany of wanting to change, wanting to start to exercise again and get back into it, you know. I met my current wife. She's my wife now. At the time, she was my girlfriend. I remember she was always telling me to go for it, you know, whatever it was, even all these different ideas I always had. I'm one of these people, my mind is always spinning, you know, it's always go, 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 go. Always telling her my ideas. And one time I had this idea. I said, I wanted to start a club, a group of people that can help others achieve their goals through physical fitness. And we started the Ho-Chunk Weightlifting Club. So I'm only the co-founder. My wife was the one that had the, I guess, you know, she was the one that started out of her pocket. So it wasn't my pocket, it was hers. She was the one that said, hey, you know, let's move forward with this, let's do this, you know. So we bought some shirts and we started telling people we were going to exercise at certain times, and they started coming and exercising with us. So that's kind of like the birth of the weightlifting club.
Talking to Paul Roberts right now, founder of the Ho-Chunk Weightlifting Club. And Paul, I'm sorry about those losses, and I appreciate you sharing your story, because I know that this isn't something that has always been easy for you. This is something that you kept to yourself. What makes you want to share it now?
Being able to relate. And there's a lot of people out there that relate to my story. And I think when we talk about, you know, upbringings and, you know, how we were raised growing up, nobody has ever had like this picture perfect upbringing. I think all of us have had different things that happen in our lives, and we kind of don't know how to deal with that in some ways. I fortunately have found in the weight room, not only in the weight room, but also running, exercising, any type of physical fitness, I have found, I guess, my warrior spirit is what I call it, that Native American warrior spirit. I have found that through physical fitness, and I have found that I can take that spirit and apply it to life, to apply it to getting through certain things that happen, you know, a death, a loss, or any type of stress that happens out there, to realize that I'm so much stronger than what I really am by exercising and pushing my body to the limit, I guess, in a sense.
Yeah, I want to get more at that philosophy that you're talking about, because as you say, this is the physical fitness is the beginning for you when it comes to wellness. It's not the end in and of itself. Mm-hmm. How does physical fitness act as sort of the conduit to improve all these other things in our lives and to feel better about ourselves and to achieve goals?
Well, that's exactly what it is. I mean, it is another pathway to reach that overall pathway of mindset. It's all about having that mindset of what you want to accomplish. It's having that ability to overcome certain things in your life, whether it be death or any type of being 300 pounds, alcoholic, addict, all of these different things, to realize that physical fitness can get you to that point of being mentally strong, you know, to having a different mindset. And that's what our group is. We are a group of Ho-Chunk tribal members, and we uplift each other's spirit. And the weight that we lift isn't always that of iron. Mm. It's of each other, of each other's spirit, of each other's confidence.
How big is the Ho-Chunk Weightlifting Club? Who shows up? Is it just guys, or is it women too? Who's there?
We have my wife's sister as well. She's a part of our group. In the past, we've had some people that came in and some people that stuck with it a little bit, but kind of fell off a little bit. You know, it is that always, what is that question? Like, how do we figure out what is the answer to this inactivity? Because I mean, right now in our society, we are, at the highest obesity rate. We are also at the highest inactivity rate. You know, how do we reach to these people and tell them, hey, you know, there is a pathway to overall wellness through physical fitness? And I think it's exploring all of these different aspects, all these different outlets, because there's running, there's like, I know they have CrossFit out there, weightlifting. I mean, it could be anything, any of these outlets out there. I know that there's a lot of natives that like doing the powwow dancing, and that's an amazing cardio workout. It's awesome.
Well, now that you've, I understand, getting into motivational speaking, and you've got me wanting to work out right now, I'm going to have to wait till we're off the air. But can you share some advice for those listening who are struggling, who don't feel like they can start this, and a little short on time? So what do you say?
Well, the one thing that I would tell anybody out there that's struggling, that's having it hard to get into that, I guess, routine, is to really find what it is that you love. Because what we start to do as people is we start to treat this exercise as a chore. And it really isn't. It's a blessing to be able to run, to be able to move, to be able to exercise. And if you're out there and you're struggling with it, try all of these different aspects. Try them all, because you will find something that you will attach to and you will love it.
Excellent. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Paul Roberts, founder of the Ho-Chunk Weightlifting Club and part of our series, First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today.